You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Dave Barry is a Pulitzer Prize-winning former humor columnist for the Miami Herald, a sometime musician, and a longtime friend of our show. He's called his latest book, which is, I counted, his umpteenth, Live Right and Find Happiness, although beer is much faster, Life Lessons and Other Ravings from Dave Barry. It's a collection of essays about a wide range of subjects, from the inanity of cable news to how stupid people look when they're wearing Google Glass. And although it's filled with his trademark irreverence and sharp wit, I suspect he also hopes it'll serve as a sincere advice book about how to be, well, happy. It's published by Putnam, and I'm pleased it has brought Dave Barry back to our show for what we think may be the 12th time, Dave.
Is it that many?
Yeah, something like that.
We'll get it right.
What qualifies you to give advice?
Well, I'm 67 years old. I've learned a couple of things. You know, actually, I wondered that very thing myself, because one of the essays in this book is a letter to my grandson, Dylan, who my son Rob, who lives here in New York, had his first child and was my first grandchild. And I thought, I'm going to write a letter and summarize all the things that I've learned in my 67 years. And I really tried to think of what I've learned that I would want to pass on to another generation. And the only thing I could come up with that I really knew was true and really believed in and really thought he should know is that you do not need to refrigerate ketchup or mustard.
Now, he's an infant.
He's a baby.
So how long
I saw him last night. He's 9 months old, so he's a little young to be refrigerating anything.
Yeah. Well, by the time he perhaps...
Oh, they'll refrigerate things on the internet by then, you know.
Do you consider yourself a happy person?
I do. But then I have led a blessed existence. I'm getting to be an old person. I haven't ever really done anything really productive in my entire life, and not many people can make that claim. Well, people
you've never done anything productive.
Well, you're in radio, so I guess I do. No, I mean, in the sense,
are you saying all people in the media are not really doing anything productive?
Well, don't you feel sometimes? I get this feeling sometimes. I mean, I'm not saying that what I do is worthless because I have been paid to do it and everything, but sometimes I look out the window. I live in Miami. See people driving by on their way to work. And I'm usually in shorts and a T-shirt and flip-flops on my way to sit in front of the computer screen and either will or will not produce something. I don't know. But I think, where are they going, all those people? They're going to do something important. And I can't really say what I'm going to do.
Well, I think that you could be a bit disillusioned. I've always felt that I was doing something important. I've done segments where I thought, I'm blowing the lid off of this thing and it's going to change the world. And, of course, nothing happens.
I got over that when I started.
It's like when talk show hosts run for office. Only a few of them actually win. But
they all think they
have this incredible following.
Because their fan base is so vocal. Well, when I got over the idea that I was going to make a difference when I started out in the newspaper business at the Daily Local News in Westchester, Pennsylvania. And if we could have, when I became an editor there, I discovered that we could say that Israel is a country located in France on the front page and nobody would call. But if we left Sagittarius out of the horoscope, the phone would ring off the hook. That's when I discovered the power of the media.
Do you think that it was easier for your parents' generation to be happier?
Yes. I have a whole essay about that. It's called The Real Mad Men. I grew up in Armonk, New York, and I was born in 47, grew up there in the 50s and 60s. So my parents were the Mad Men generation. My dad rode the train to New York every day. His friends were advertising executives.
But he was a Presbyterian.
He ran a social work agency called the New York City Mission Society. So he rode the train. But that was that generation. And it's just like I'm Mad Men, they all smoked and they all drank. But they also had fun, and they had fun after they became parents. I remember when I was a kid, the parties that went on at my house, and then they would rotate to somebody else's house. But they had, you know, giant fun parties where they danced, they sang, they played charades. They did all these things that my generation kind of stopped cold doing when we had kids and became parents.
Your parents actually did things like stealing giant letters from the IBM headquarters in Armonk. Now, your father was, a Presbyterian minister, but he was also a raucous partier.
I have to clarify. Yeah, well, my dad.
Were you embarrassed by that?
No, my dad was a good. No, he drank and smoked like all of the other dads of the 50s. You know, they were not. That's what they did, you know. But just to clarify, the IBM Corporation was building its world headquarters in Armonk. And there were, one night my parents had a scavenger hunt party, which went on, as many of those did, till all hours. And in the morning, my brother Phil came running into my room and said, "There's some giant bees in our living room." And I thought he meant the insect. So I went out into the living room, and there are these two huge wooden bees, which were letter bees, which came from the IBM sign, which apparently had been one of the items on the scavenger. So these people, and I'm telling you, these were like stockbrokers, lawyers. They were like, you know, responsible, upright citizens. Somehow they had gotten and stolen part of the IBM sign. And if anybody from IBM is listening, I think we're long past the statute of limitations. Get over it.
Well, a lot of the lessons in your book involve letting things go. The statute of statute of limitation, not worrying.
There's
so
also
much.
A statute of imitations. For example, you no longer can do James Cagney. It's just done.
Right.
So anyway, go ahead.
Yeah.
You dirty rat. Oh, no, that's the guy that's on his
phone. There was the Cary Grant and there was the Betty Davis.
Yeah, you can't do those anymore.
We've even gotten past Richard Nixon.
I hope.
But you list some things that you are worried about, like your 16-year-old daughter, Sophie, driving on the streets of Miami, your wife being stolen away by David Beckham, of course, Vladimir Putin, everybody worries about him. How do you choose what to worry about and what not to worry about?
Well, in the case of my daughter, it's very easy to worry. I drive the roads of Miami where my theory is, when I first got there, I thought nobody knew the law. I now realize everybody in Miami is driving according to the law of his or her individual country of origin. So there's a lot of theories of how to drive going on. And you've got a lot of seniors driving in South Florida. And they use the seeing eye wife method of driving. And I'm not making this up. I have been in cars with people.
You mean make a turn at the next corner?
No. What I mean is the man drives because the man has always driven the car. But he can no longer see. So his wife, who is sitting in the shotgun seat, does the seeing for him. Saying, "Harry, the arrow's green. It's green. No, it's yellow. Stop." It's like, you know, that's the style of driving. And I'm not.
You've been in the back seat.
Yes. I wish I were kidding. I'm not kidding about that. So my daughter is now allowed to get a driver's permit in Florida. And the point of this essay is just because the state of Florida thinks you're qualified to drive, it doesn't mean you are. The state of Florida, there's nobody doesn't believe is qualified to drive. Kangaroos could legally get licenses in Florida.
You write about your travels and you talk about bad images, places that have bad image problems like Brazil, Belgium, Russia, but also Miami.
Well, Miami does have Miami has an unfortunate reputation. I have tried my best to correct that. And I even came up with a tourism promotion slogan, and I had bumper stickers made that said, "Come back to Miami, we weren't shooting at you." unfortunately, people still think of Miami as a dangerous place.
You seem thoroughly surprised by your visits to Brazil and Russia. What did you take away from that?
Well, I was sent to Russia with Ridley Pearson, who is a co-author of mine, as part of a State Department program designed to improve relations between the two countries. And that was in September.
That was before Ukraine?
And you see how that's working out. But we actually had a really good time, a really interesting time. The Russians, the people we met were really nice. We did have a couple of instances where we kind of felt we were being hassled a little bit by officials, but that went pretty well. Brazil. I went over the World Cup. My wife is a sports writer. She covers the World Cup. And so my daughter and I went down to visit her. And a lot of Miamians have been to Brazil. There are a lot of Brazilians in Miami. And when I'd say we're going to Brazil, they all said the same thing. "Oh, Brazil, it's a lovely place. Do not wear any jewelry." Or Brazilians, they're great. "Do not carry any money." Or "Carry a little wad of money to give them when they show you the knife," you know. So we were there for 2 weeks. Nothing ever happened. We weren't. Often in not such great neighborhoods. The Brazilians are just wonderful, lovely people. It's a wonderful country. But my daughter and I concluded that we could make a living down there just meeting the planes of American tourists who presumably all read the same guidebook I did and say, "Give me your money." And they'd hand it right
over. I'll hold it for you until you have to leave.
No, just say you've got a knife. Don't even have to have it. Just say or just show them a receipt for a knife. They would throw money at you.
Well, you also talk about how the Russians are seeding clouds to make rain. Now, we tried that in this country and gave up on it.
Apparently, it's not good for the environment. But when I got to Moscow, it was called City Day. It was the birthday of Moscow and 800 whatever years ago. And they always have good weather on Moscow City Day because the government dumps this stuff into the clouds. And not only, I mean, like here, if you did that, you would get like 97 lawsuits from Greenpeace and whatever. But over there, the government is quite proud of it. And I thought, wouldn't it be cool if like we controlled the weather over here?
My guest is Dave Barry, whose latest book, have you counted how many you've written?
No, nobody has
any
idea.
I think you have 14 novels alone.
I don't write them anymore. I just go around promoting them now.
This book is called Live Right and Find Happiness, although beer is much faster. Why did you decide to write the chapter on cable news and dialogue?
Well, because I wrote that right after the Malaysian airliner mystery, where CNN went on for, how many months there with absolutely, I mean, let's be honest, these are professional journalists. They had no information. They had absolutely no information and yet had to fill 12, 15, 17 hours a day of programming.
Why do you think they did that? Because there were other news stories, major news stories occurring. Why do you think they just focused on that one story?
I'm assuming that it got good ratings. And I truly do not understand why, since it was a parody of itself. There was so little actual information. There was never any new information at all.
And you're a journalist.
Here's every day it was like, here's something floating on the ocean. It could be a plane part. Oh, days later, no, that wasn't a plane. But look, here's something else floating on the ocean. There's things floating on the ocean again. My God, well, it's got like 8 guys with suits in here to talk about that. What could that be? So anyway, I wrote a parody of where nothing, absolutely nothing happens, how CNN covers it.
Do you think you have a special insight because you are a former newspaper man?
Yeah, I think I have a special insight because I sit around all day watching a lot of television, and so I'm kind of familiar with how it sounds, really, more than anything else.
Even though you characterize yourself as an early adopter or a quick adherent to new technologies, what is your problem with Google Glass?
I have to tell you, I bought Google Glass because I buy everything that's electronic, whether, you know, and I thought this was wonderful, this thing you wear on your, it's the wearable computer you wear on your head. And first of all, you look like an idiot. But then you can't really use it. I couldn't really see anything. So I gave it a poor review. Google itself is not as well, sort of given up on it. But here's the at least to me funny part. Yesterday, the day before my book tour was to begin, I did a special event talking about this book at Google headquarters.
Were they upset with you?
No, they were actually, I don't want to get anybody over at Google fired, but they seemed to pretty much agree with me about the uselessness of Google Glass.
How long did you try it? And did anything good come out of it?
Well, my wife and daughter laughed a lot at me because you really looks like my daughter refused to enter a restaurant where I was wearing it. My wife said, "Why didn't you just go buy joke glasses at Party City? You would look more dignified."
Is your family comfortable that you use them for so much of your comic material? And do you know if your wife is attracted to David Beckham?
Well, that's two separate questions. I'll take them in order. My family, I've had a rule for many years, which is if I write about a family member and it might be awkward, I always make sure that family member sees it, and especially my kids. I've always told my kids, you know, if you don't want me to publish that, I won't publish it, and then somebody else maybe could put you through college.
But there are comics who've been sued by ex-spouses.
Yeah.
Because they had made them into laughing stocks.
Well,
even though most of us understand that's what comics do.
That's what they do.
You can't take it personally.
But generally, I'm much more likely, if I'm writing about my spouse, to be making fun of myself. Now, about the David Beckham question, that's a more tricky question. I have put in the book a picture of my high school yearbook photo. I graduated from Pleasantville High School, Pleasantville, New York, 1965. And I look hideous. It's a really – and it's – not like that was a bad day. That was the best I could look in 1965. I have these Soviet Union-style eyeglasses. I have a very bad haircut. My dad cut my hair. As we established, he's a Presbyterian minister, so they don't train them, the Presbyterian minister, in haircutting.
Well, there were no barbershops in town?
There were, but we didn't have much money and, you know, saving money. So he bought clippers at Grand Central Station. And, you know, there's all this talk. People always want to get politicians always want to get assault rifles out of the hands of civilians. And I say, fine with that, but let's get electric clippers out of the hands of people like my dad, you know, because they do untold damage to their – so anyway, my point is I have a bad image of myself. Dating back to high school and beyond. And so here I am. I'm living in Miami now. And David Beckham, who is considered by many people, including, I think, my wife, one of the handsomest men in the world, wants to start a soccer team in Miami. He wants to bring a soccer team. So he's wooing Miami. He's wooing the civic leaders. He's wooing the media.
Who's the most important soccer writer in Miami? That's my wife, Michelle Kaufman. So David Beckham, he calls my wife. They want to get together. David wants to get together with your wife for a one-on-one. And she's very nice to me about it. She's very professional. But I think she's lying. And if David Beckham's listening, and I know he is because he's about to pledge, David Beckham, get out of my city. Get away from my wife.
He has a very attractive wife.
He does, but, you don't see me hitting on his wife, do you?
Just one more thing, because we talked about you and technology. Do you take advantage of the new technologies? Do you tweet humorous things?
Yes, I tweet, I blog, I don't Snapchat because I don't know what that means.
And you no longer work for newspaper.
I don't, and that's a giant step forward for technology.
Dave Barry's latest book is Live Right and Find Happiness, Although Beer is Much Faster, Life Lessons and Other Ravings from Dave Barry. It's published by Putnam. Dave, it's always a pleasure to see you.
It is. Thank you.
And thank you for braving the cold of New York
to
come on our show.
Leonard, I had no choice.
When you could be down in warm Miami.
They gave me no choice, Leonard.